We are taping today's session. I think I titled it Ethical Decisions in Sickness and in Health, or Ethical Dilemmas in Sickness and in Health. I forget which, but it's the same idea. For those of you who haven't met me and who I haven't talked with yet, my name is Mary Carlson, and I have until June of this year been a social worker at a hospital in Minneapolis for 4 years. And I've been doing social work in healthcare, nursing homes, hospitals, and home care for the last 10 years. So medical social work is really my field of choice, obviously, and my field of experience. And that's the field from which I talk, and it's important for you to know that so that you know I'm not a physician, I'm not a nurse, I'm not an ethicist, and I'm not a pastor. But I am a social worker. Part of the reason I wanted to talk about this topic today is that I was a member for many years of our hospital medical ethics committee, where we brought a number of cases over the years for discussion when we had ethical dilemmas, either in treatment or care of people in our particular setting. So that much of what I want to talk about has to do with how our ethics committee looked at those conversations and dilemmas and what happened with those. I'd like also to foster some discussion, which is, in my opinion, one of the best ways to learn, so that any of you who've had experience, and I bet a great number of you have had some of these similar experiences, can also bring those up. When I talk about ethical decisions both in sickness and in health, I do that purposely because I have a real bias that you'll see throughout the next hour, which is that if indeed when we are healthy, as most of us are currently in this room, we do some thinking about the issues of the day, which we'll be discussing, we will forestall lots of problems for ourselves and for our loved ones at the time when and if decisions need to be made in the ethical realm when we're sick. That's why I'm saying we need to discuss both. Much of what we talk about today will focus on people who are sick already. But if those folks had done certain things to make clear some of their wishes, the ethical dilemmas may not have been as difficult for the loved ones that surrounded them at that time. Okay, I think we're going to start out with a little of the academic outline first, and then I have a case study that we're going to read through and talk about. You could talk to any ethicist, and he or she would give you a whole bunch of ethical concepts that we could talk about today. Ethics is a vast, broad field. As I explained already, I want to just limit today's discussion to some of the ethical concepts that we used in our medical ethics committee at the hospital, because those are the ones that I know about, have a working knowledge of, and feel competent to even talk about. We may well bring up others during our discussion then, and that would be just fine. So don't say that this is it for medical ethics concepts. There are lots. We could spend a day on it, I'm sure. But let me just go through them briefly with some little discussion. They're not in any order of importance particularly either, although I'd like to start with 1 and 2 first, because these assume competency on the part of an individual. That means that person has the capacity to reason and make judgments about medical care, therefore is competent. Now, there are lots of legal definitions of competency, medical definitions, social definitions, and we can get into that a little bit. But basically, these first two are talking about the individual person who knows what he or she's talking about and is about. The first ethical concept, then, we talk about is autonomy. That is, the individual's right to decide and make his or her own decisions about medical treatment. Many of the laws in our country are based on this sort of personal right to privacy and right to self-determination. That holds true with medical care, too. In every state, as far as I'm aware, people have the right to refuse treatment. They are under no obligation to be a patient. We don't have to go see a doctor if we don't want to. If we have the capacity to say, no, I don't want to go, we don't have to go. In this area of autonomy, I have written the term advanced directives. I use that because I'm aware that people come from a lot of different states. And last I checked, 38 states in the country had passed living will legislation. Living will is sort of the common term for something called an advance directive, which is basically that. Some written directions to your family and to your physician of what you want done in the case of your ever becoming incompetent or unable to decide what you want for treatment. That's why I put it under autonomy, because we can only write these advance directives when we're competent, when we're healthy, when we're together in our heads, before we have Alzheimer's late stage. We need to think about that. Okay, the second concept, ethically, under the for people who are competent, is that concept of informed consent. It's a fairly technical concept, and again, any hospital you're in is going to have its own definition of informed consent. Generally, however, what it means is we cannot medically do anything to you, including give you any pills, put any tubes in you, do any surgeries, cut you anywhere without your okay. And your okay isn't just to say okay. Your okay must say, I understand what it means that you're going to do this, what the risks are, what the benefits are, what the chances are that it's going to help me or hurt me, and that you're actually fully able to repeat that to your physician. Now, how many times does that happen when you go to the doctor? Not much. It'll take the time. Legally, they're supposed to, and you could, any time you want, question them. Now, you haven't fully explained, doctor, why you suggest this medication instead of this one. What are the side effects of this one? What are the chances of that side effect affecting me? All of those things are supposed to go into informed consent. Where it becomes really critical are big deals like surgeries, like whether or not you want to be resuscitated in the event that your heart or breathing stops, those kind of big decisions. But technically and legally, they're supposed to happen any time we get any medical treatment. Again, we can only give our informed consent if we're competent, mentally with it, yeah? Okay, starting with number three, I've written in very small letters here, incompetency. I don't know if there's a better word for those or not. I don't like the words myself. But that's what's generally used. One fairly new word in the field is decision-making capacity. So under 1 and 2, does this individual have capacity to make a decision when in some areas of life they might not be particularly competent? I'm not particularly competent with math, but I can make a decision about my medical treatment. So maybe decision-making capacity is going to gain acceptance rather than incompetency or competency. Under incompetency, we have proxy decision-making. This only comes into play when there is a person who is not competent and has not left any written instructions, no advance directive, living will, directive to physician, whatever you might call it in your particular locality. So this person has left no indication in writing what this person might want done. Somebody else has to make the decision. That's what the word proxy is about. Somebody else. Normally, that is a family member. And in most localities, the statutes of the state also list out legally who is the next of kin who would be the proxy decision maker. First, it's a spouse, a legal spouse. Next would be adult children. This is for an adult. This is for an incompetent adult. And then different states might go down and vary, go into where nieces and nephews and cousins and whoever else might. So the ethical concepts under that proxy decision-making notion are substituted judgment. In other words, is this person really able, capable, competent to make a judgment for the person who can't make the decision? In other words, how long has this person known the patient, shall we say? I don't like the use of that word either. Hold on. But who is best able to make a substitute judgment? Again, in the eyes of the law, it's usually the next of kin, legally, that we talked about. Second, and again, these aren't in any particular order here either, but second is the notion of what is in the best interest of this person who is not competent to make a decision currently. That is the old, from Hippocrates, way back, notion of beneficence. We have a duty as healthcare providers to benefit patients. What is in that person's best interest? Third, and this is a big one, This is what we throw around a lot, quality of life, life quality. There have been some efforts to define quality of life in the medical literature. Let me just read from one citation from the Annals of Internal Medicine by a man named Braithwaite. He defined quality of life in terms of five areas. And if you look at these five areas of life for someone, then maybe we can say this person has a good quality of life or a bad quality of life. Just for your consideration here. The first one are the areas of cognition and recognition. Does the person have the capacity to recognize another individual as familiar to him or her? And can that person understand who that person is? Or the surroundings, perhaps. Second, does that person have motor activity? Is the motor part of the brain working so that there is some motion and movement of eyes, nose, mouth? Or is the person completely without any motor function whatsoever? Third is memory or awareness of time. Here's my mother. She's got a pretty good quality of life at the moment. She can't remember if I've been there now or 5 minutes ago, or whether she just went to the bathroom or it's been 3 hours. She has no idea what time it is, no idea what day, season, year, at all. So that's one of them. Fourth is consciousness. How this person defined consciousness, I can't really recall. But basically, my assumption is it's an understanding of one's environment and relation to the environment, some sort of interaction with the environment. And the fifth is language or other intelligent means of communication. That's been a real important one in some of the cases that our ethics committee discussed, because when we can tell, even if it's a twitch of the eyebrow from somebody, that they're hearing us and understanding and trying to communicate something, that would say something to us about quality of life. Okay, that's open to lots of discussion. Lots of discussion. That's only one person's suggestion of how to define that. Next is the burden versus benefit balancing. The long-ago concept, again, from Hippocrates, the opposite of beneficence is non-maleficence. What that means is the duty not to do harm, to do no harm to a patient. So is the proposed treatment going to hurt that person more than help that person? And how do we talk about that? Who decides it? Last but not least, we also use frequently the ethical notion of unique characteristics of this person. My memory is very strong about a man who was 60, who was in our intensive care unit for 3 months, essentially non-responsive, and his wife said, you know, my husband was a golfer. That's all he did. He was a professional golfer. That was his life. Will he ever golf again? Every doctor in the case said no. He will never golf again. With 99.9% certainty, this man will golf again. And she said, then I don't think he would want to continue whatever treatments we were doing for him. Another person never golfed in his life, then we wouldn't talk about golfing. That was one pretty extraordinary example to me. But what, for that individual person, made life? And is that going to be possible again? Is another sort of consideration for the people who are making those decisions for somebody. Any questions on these at the moment? We're going to work from these right now. Not that they're a complete listing or that's all we'll talk about. Does that make sense, what I said? Make more sense in a minute. Okay, we're going to have a couple lovely volunteers read a case history for us as we read along. We're going to have some discussion about that. Let me see. Folks might have to share. I don't know how many I need. You pass them around. Marilyn, Sue, or one should read. Ron's going to start, and you would read. They're going to do it. I'm going to have it read for the sake of the tape. Otherwise, it's not that you can't read. But sometimes it's all right, too, to hear somebody's voice other than mine. Can I pass a few more down?
Where's this copy from?
Be nice. Yes, let me give you the citation. It's from the Medical Ethics Advisor. And I did not get their response to my request to reproduce this before I left for Holden. So I do need to ask you to give it back to me. But I have the exact citation if you want to find it in your own libraries. I have to be real careful about that. We all do, copyright laws. So I will ask you to leave it on the chair, return it to me, because I didn't hear back from them whether it was okay. But it's a small, it's not a pamphlet, but a newsletter, the Medical Ethics Advisor, which is a national newsletter. This was from January of 1989, so it's quite a recent case and actually a fairly momentous court decision. I've not listed the court decision here. I have it, and I'll give it to you when we're done with discussion. So, Marilyn, if you go ahead, where are you? Oh, she's over there now. Great. Okay. You confused me. Thanks.
Mary O'Connor is a 77-year-old widow with two children, Helen and Joan, both practical nurses. After her husband's death in 1967, O'Connor lived alone in her apartment in the New York City area where she was employed in hospital administration. In 1983, she retired from her job after 20 years of service. Over the years, a number of her close relatives died of cancer. Her husband died of brain cancer. The last two of her nine brothers died of cancer, one in 1975 and the other in 1977. During their final years, she regularly visited them in the hospital and cared for them when they were home. In November 1984, after being informed that her stepmother had died of cancer in Florida, O'Connor had an attack of congestive heart failure and was hospitalized. She was released from the hospital in December 1984. In July 1985, she suffered the first of a series of strokes causing brain damage and related disabilities that rendered her unable to care for herself. She became passive, could only carry on limited conversations, and could not walk, eat, dress, or care for her bodily needs without assistance from others. Upon her release from the hospital in August 1985, O'Connor resided with her daughter Helen, who, together with Joan and another woman, provided her with full-time care. In December 1987, O'Connor had a second major stroke, causing additional physical and mental disabilities. She became unresponsive and unable to stand or feed herself. She had to be spoon-fed by others. Her gag reflex was also impaired, as a result of which she experienced difficulty swallowing and thus could only eat pureed foods. In that condition, her daughters found that they could no longer care for her at home. When she left the hospital in February 1988, she was transferred to the Ruth Taylor Institute, a longtime geriatric care facility associated with the Westchester County Medical Center. In conjunction with the transfer, her daughters submitted a document signed by both of them to be included in her medical file, stating that their mother had expressed the wish in many conversations that no artificial life support be started or maintained to sustain her life, and that they wanted that request to be honored.
During the initial part of her stay at the Institute, the staff found O'Connor cooperative and capable of sitting in a chair and interacting with her surroundings. However, in June, her condition deteriorated. She became stuporous, virtually not responsive, and developed a fever. On June 20th, she was transferred from the Institute to the hospital. The hospital staff determined that she was suffering from dehydration, sepsis, and probably pneumonia. They also found that she had lost her gag reflex, making it impossible for her to swallow food or liquids without medical assistance. She showed marked improvement after receiving fluids, limited nourishment, and antibiotics intravenously. Within a few days, she became alert, able to follow simple commands and respond verbally to simple questions. Her inability to swallow persisted, and her physician determined that a nasogastric tube should be used to provide more substantial nourishment. When O'Connor's daughters objected to that procedure, the matter was brought before the hospital's ethics committee, which found that it would be inappropriate to withhold the treatment under the circumstances. On July 15th, the hospital sought court authorization to use the nasogastric tube, claiming that without that relief, O'Connor would die of thirst and starvation within a few weeks. Because her condition otherwise remained fairly stable, the procedure would preserve her life for several months, perhaps several years. In an opposing affidavit, her daughter stated that was against their mother's expressed wishes. They noted the number of relatives she had comforted during prolonged final illnesses and urged that the effect of her past statements be evaluated against that background.
Any reactions to what you think the court ought to do in this situation?
She had not read prior preparation.
She had left nothing written.
We don't have a copy. Was she conscious at the time that the ethics committee was deciding whether or not to use the tool?
Conscious doesn't sound like it. Unresponsive.
Yeah, it sounded to me like she had regained consciousness and was alert and so forth. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
She was not in a coma.
Right, not in a coma. Unable to tell if she understood what was said to her back, but did respond with yes or no.
My mother was like that. She was in the hospital, and when they put the food in her mouth, she swallowed it. Otherwise, she didn't even know anyone was there.
She had her gag reflex, so if it was in there, it went down.
I would the daughters. I think the quality of life would definitely just...
And quality of life is one of the issues that comes up. Yeah.
Well, if they're just the person alive and they're in and there's nothing else, you just will be vegetable. I just don't see it at all. I think it's totally wrong. I don't think there's anybody here that wants it.
Anybody here that wants it? She could live maybe years. Live maybe years.
I haven't read it.
Lived 4 years in this kind of... She took care of him at home. Yeah, was he with a feeding tube, an artificial? Yeah.
I think I'd want to know, if I were making a decision, what the likelihood is that she would at some point lapse into a coma or lose consciousness. I think there's a distinction between using a respirator, something to help you breathe, really make you breathe, and something which gives you basic nourishment. And I think that distinction is even sharper if the person who is getting the basic nourishment is conscious and is alert. Because, you know, after all, let's suppose that she had no way to feed herself because she was paralyzed, couldn't use her hands, but she was conscious and she could swallow. Well, certainly in that case, in that situation, we would all say somebody should feed her. That would be the job of the nurse's aide. Somebody should feed her. And so I see a distinction here between a respiration ventilation type apparatus and a nutrition hydration type apparatus.
I wrote down the nature of medical treatments. One of the hottest topics currently is whether feeding and hydration by tubes is medical treatment or not, and whether it is artificially prolonging life or not. And that is a big ethical question. Yeah.
I would suggest that the doctor and the people in the court walk around with a nasal gastric tube and make the decision for a week.
Yeah, but they could put in a gastrostomy.
That isn't what they're saying. They say they're going to do a nasal gastric.
But that's not life either.
But it says she's alert.
Yeah, you're making the decision for somebody else, not for yourself.
But I ask you a question. I guess, you know, I really don't understand anything about health care and any of these, you know, technical things. But it says here she would have died of starvation and thirst, right? I mean, isn't that a pretty painful thing to go through?
No. Who knows? Has any of us gone through it?
But I would think...
You can ask 20 doctors.
I've been told that.
You can ask 50
no
doctors, and they'll disagree.
Really?
Yes. Many doctors would say that there are fewer, more painless ways to die than slowly by dehydration or lack of food. That's an okay way to die. There are many doctors who make a big assumption also that we would feel that pain. We don't know that. That is an unanswered question.
Hasn't anyone that's going through that been able to be alert enough to say?
No, because if they're going through it, they're alert enough to say whether they want it or not, and then they get it or don't. Okay, is that accurate for anybody here who's in healthcare?
Well, I think people make choices to do that. They're allowed to do it. I have never observed
something natural. Yeah, in the nursing home, we had many people who made the choice to stop eating and then also said, I don't want it to, and could say it very clearly. And I didn't hear those people saying that it was a painful way to go, but they had made that conscious decision, so that probably decided whether they were going to have it hurt or not. Who knows about the power of our brains? Yeah.
I had a friend that made that decision. He had brain surgery, and he made the decision, but it was the wrong decision. They forced him to eat, and he lived for a long time in perfect health. And not perfect health, he died of cancer, but he recovered from that. But he was not that far gone, but it was his decision. He just decided that he wanted to go, and he was going to use that as his way to go.
Competency has a real difficult twist to it, and that is depression. And whoever is sick is depressed, generally speaking. Nobody wants to be sick. Well, sick people want to be sick. I mean, mentally ill people might want to be sick. But most of us are depressed when we even have a cold. So who's to say if you're making a competent decision? I've heard one physician who's written in New England Journal of Medicine and other places, can't think of his name, propose that nobody in a hospital is competent. Because the hospital environment by nature strips you of the ability to think clearly, be in control of your life, feel like a human being. I really kind of listened to that for a while. Wasn't sure what I thought about that. I mean, it would put medical care in a total uproar. Nobody could make decisions. We had to kind of, somebody else made fun of it and said, roll the patient out of the hospital onto the sidewalk, ask the question, roll the patient back in. Nevertheless, it has a little bit of merit. If you know about anybody who's been in the intensive care unit and had ICU psychosis, it'll make you crazy looking at the same walls all day long. They don't know up from down, and they don't remember being in there. But they're very clear while they're there. They know their family, they know where they are. Take them away, you ask them 2 weeks later, that was, you know, must have been terrible in that ICU for a week. I don't remember a minute. It's a good question, too.
I think we have to be careful about the age of the individual involved. I think lately we have begun to think too much that if a person is of an advanced age, that it's a little easier to say, stop the treatment, as compared to someone who perhaps is in their 40s or 50s. And I think that's dangerous, just because a person is of advanced age, to begin to think that maybe, you know, their quality of life now won't be so good, or they've had a good life up to this point, and now maybe it's time to let them go. But when we talk about making a decision, we're talking about making a decision for somebody else using circumstantial evidence, really, if they haven't left the declaration. And earlier this spring, there was an account of a woman in New York, an elderly woman, who had only a sister. And the woman fell into a coma from some condition. And her sister, when asked by the physicians what she thought her comatose sister's wishes would be about continuing treatment, said, well, she has indicated on a number of occasions that she would not want treatment continued. And based on that, the physicians were going to discontinue treatment. However, before they had the opportunity to do so, she regained consciousness for a brief period of time, long enough for the physician to say to her, Mary, this is what's happening. Would you want us to discontinue treatment? And her response was, that would be a very difficult decision. And then she lapsed again in the coma.
It is not infrequent.
Once again, we're making a decision for somebody else based on what we think they want, and it's very, very difficult. And that's an example of how you may make the wrong decision.
But aren't we playing God by having extraordinary needs to keep them alive as well?
Yes.
I guess we need to define what's extraordinary. What's the supportive kind of care?
We're playing God.
To me, that's a little strong.
We're playing God when we make a choice for someone else.
Yeah, what about the case of who has no one else?
Right.
What about the person who has absolutely no one else? They're rare. They are rare. Almost everyone has somebody. But what about the person who really has nobody in the world who will say, I have anything to do with them? Relatives who say, I haven't seen so-and-so for 30 years. Don't ask me. I have no idea what he'd want. Who's left deciding? A doctor? Hospital ethics committee? The state? The state, in most of these court cases, is the entity that has the responsibility, shall we say, of preserving life. And normally, the state, if that's who is bringing the case. And I think one of the questions that arises is who intervenes? Because probably each one of us knows about a situation in the last 20 years where some family has said, you wouldn't want it, don't do it. It's not them. It's quietly not them. The person dies, everything goes just smoothly. It's now, recently, that more and more people, be they physicians or nurses or family members, are coming in and saying, I don't think so. Something's going to have to happen here. And more of these cases are getting into the courts. Is that where they belong? A lot of the question comes back to, why are we having the court systems, the legislatures, the state decide this, when historically it has been a decision of family, physician, and clergy? Often, family, physician, clergy. Shouldn't it maybe be back to family, physician, and clergy? I don't know.
Agree.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with what is being done in other countries in this regard?
Yeah. Well, not. I can't speak for all other countries in this regard, but generally speaking, yeah, Great Britain. If you're talking about the scarce resource question, that is another ethical issue I don't have up here. That is, you start looking at resources, economic in particular, for healthcare. Great Britain has made a decision. Talk about age. That anybody 55 or over doesn't get kidney dialysis. Period. It's a socialized system. They have limited resources. They got lots of prenatal care they need. They have benefits for people going in every year for a physical, preventative health care. We're getting there, folks. In this country, we are getting there soon. We can't keep letting our health care expenditures zip up. When we first, do you remember the days when we first had kidney dialysis machines? They weren't available everywhere for everybody. Who knows people who didn't get it? There are people. In some places in our country, smaller towns, for instance, they had committees set up in the towns to decide who got it and who didn't. Now that has to do with social worth, like this gentleman was talking about. So somebody's 55 versus 25. Are we to say the 25-year-old is going to be, quote, worth more in our society? Those are some of the issues that come up, too. Yeah?
No, if you look at the writings of Simonton and Siegel, Love, Medicine, and Healing, and the suggestion would be that we all have a will to live, you know, and maybe we're almost programmed that way. So the decision is not at the onset of the illness, but the decision was made way back when. And so now it's not a case of whether you're going to live or just how long you're going to exist, you know, the spirit within type of thing. So it's not completely in our hands. We can do what we want to, and we can make them exist for a while, but without the will to live.
Definitions of life and existence are interesting. A lot of people have said, a lot of seniors groups around the country have advocated for legislation making legal the living will because they say we are keeping alive so many people at the end of their life who don't want to be in this world anymore. They're ready to not be. It's not necessarily only old people. Many people who are extremely sick, irreversibly, or terminally, or whatever word you want to use, which is, by the way, another big contradiction and argument is how we define who is irreversibly ill because of those people like your friend who all of a sudden are fine, whatever, you know, causes that. What was I saying before you argued?
Pardon me? Can I tell you two stories?
Sure.
My husband had congestive heart failure. He collapsed in the doctor's office maybe 2 years into his illness. And the doctor said, we've got to make a decision here. He asked Fred, he said, what do you want? He said, if you collapse again, if If you go, do you want to be resuscitated? Do you want to be put on machines? It's a decision you have to make. He was not able to make that machine. I mean, that decision. So the doctor said to me, he said, well, what are your wishes in this? And I said, well, I'm not God, and I think that I would call someone I would not want it. I said, let me think about it. He said, well, talk about it with Fred and decide what it is you want. I said, well, I would call the medics. I said, more for myself than for him. And 2 years, 3 years went by, and we never did make a living will. When he was milk-pulled, however, in the hospital, we had him milk-pulled. But I had difficulty. One time when I called the ambulance, he collapsed. We have just a local ambulance with local medics. They were on another case, and when I got to a corner of a place, these medics came on, and they almost forced me to start IVs and all this stuff. And I said, is it no code? He said, do you have a living will? I said, no, not with me. And I went through agonies. Also, he went through agonies. And when we got there, it was okay. So then it progressed and progressed without the living will. The day that he died, that night, we had gone to the doctor's office. And I came home with the living will. And I did not need it.
No. And I bet lots of people have just lived it. That is the moment. Bring up a good point, which is the doctor saying to you, depends on how the doctor might say it, what would you want us to do versus what do you think he would want us to do?
And one thing I forgot to tell you, he said, if that was my father, I would not want him resuscitated.
Yeah. Power of the doc. Have you ever heard that from a doctor? If it was my mother, this is what I do. Well, what do most of us do? We listen to the doctor.
But I didn't.
There's a lot of power in that. Yeah, good for you. Had you discussed that? I mean, like way back when you were young and married, like I'm going to be soon?
Hey. No.
Peter and I had big discussions about this. He says, it sounds like you'd let me go. And I said, it sounds like you'd keep me going. We started, and then we came to today, so 50 years ago, people didn't usually talk about it. That's right. That's a big concern. Yeah.
And sometimes there's someone in the relationship who has their little idea of what should happen, and they can really cause a lot of frustration. Brother-in-law who was definitely dying. You know, daughter comes home from the East, said she was a preemie when she was born. Dad did everything possible to keep me alive. I want everything possible done to keep Dad alive.
Yeah, like it's directly translatable. Yeah.
Good lands.
Well, and what happens in those situations, you know, most of the time, I mean, 90%, 95% of these cases are decided with the few people. The family, the doctor, maybe the clergy, maybe the social worker, whoever's around. But more and more, if there's one person who says no, if there's 15 children and one says, do everything, resuscitate them, put them on a respirator, do it all, the doctor will do it. And the doctor must in that situation. If there's no spouse, 15 children, they're all equal deciders, crassly, the decision becomes who will sue? Who cares? I mean, who cares otherwise? If somebody's not going to sue, we'll go with 14 out of 15. That's pretty good. Or 6 out of 7 or 2 out of 3. But that's what physicians and hospitals are facing more and more.
Can I add one more
thing? You can.
When he died, I waited to make sure that he was dead because when the team came and I did not have a living will, they would have had to start resuscitating him.
That's right.
They did that to an older lady. The bill was $3,000.
There have been people now who have sued paramedics for assault and battery and have sued hospitals for doing this.
Well, see, the medics
who didn't want it. Most medics in most places must do it, no matter what. You can wave a living will in front of their nose, they still must do it. It's not true in Hennepin County, Minneapolis.
You can waive a living will in front of their nose, and they don't have, I mean, they don't have to start all of that. But in almost, it's a trial run to see what happens with that. Let me just read the court decision here for this case, and then we're going to go on for a little bit. First, the trial court, it's the lowest court, denied the hospital's application, concluding that it was contrary to the patient's wishes. So they said, the hospital can't put in this tube. So the patient wouldn't want it. The appellate court, on appeal, confirmed that ruling with two judges dissenting. So they agreed. Patient shouldn't have to do it. The New York Court of Appeals, however, the highest court they went to, concluded that the order should be reversed and the hospital's petition granted, holding that there was not clear and convincing proof that the patient had made a firm and settled commitment, while competent, to decline this type of medical assistance under these circumstances. In other words, this person had never written or said anything about food and fluids given by a tube, particularly that kind of medical assistance. Now, as the majority of the court explained, although Mrs. O'Connor's statements about her desire to decline life-saving treatments were repeated over a number of years, there is nothing other than speculation to persuade the fact finder that her expressions were more than immediate reactions to the unsettling experience of seeing or hearing of another's unnecessarily prolonged death. Her comments are, in fact, no different than those that many of us might make after witnessing an agonizing death. So it's not enough that she saw lots of relatives die and said, I don't want to ever die like that. And that's what we heard time after time with this hospital ethics committee. Families would come in and say, but she said many times, don't let me die like your father died. I don't want to die like my mother died. Don't put me through that. That's not enough. That, what's that? Like that person died, what's that? That doesn't make any sense to this particular court. Now, that's the court of New York, and there are lots of court cases around, but that's just an example of what's happening in our country. Let me put up a few things on the board. If you allow me to just be on my soapbox for a minute. I'm pretty shy about my opinions. Many of you know that's not really true. There are 6 issues that I would ask you, please, I would beg you, and I think any doctor or nurse in here, and probably any family member, would beg you to talk about with the people who you love. That means we're talking about it in health. We're talking about it at a young age, at an old age, married, single, it doesn't matter. I think these are important to have, not only verbal, but written. There are a lot of problems with living wills. Don't get me wrong. Don't go away saying, Mary said, I've got a red living will, and if I fill it out, get it in a certain form, then everything will be fine. Because the issue with the living will, or any advanced directives, is we cannot, just like Mrs. O'Connor, predict every situation that could happen to us. We have 50 people in the room, we'll have 50 situations on how we die. We know that. We're unique. Thank goodness we are. But when Minnesota, just this year, Minnesota, the progressive thinking aware state with a lot of senior citizens' lobbies and so forth, 38th state to pass living will legislation, has made, I think, a very good bill in many ways, because one thing it says is you must include a statement about artificial nutrition or hydration and your wishes about that. If you say something generally about, I don't want, quote, extraordinary measures, that's not good enough. So you have to say, I believe that feeding by a nasogastric tube is extraordinary measures, and if I cannot swallow on my own, I don't want a tube. NG or right into the stomach. You have to write that out. And that was a compromise worked out by the, quote, pro-life forces and other forces on how to list that. So that's a big deal. So if you have a statute in your state, make sure you read it. Know what it means. And know that you're writing one that's worthwhile. If not, it'll be tossed out. It won't mean a thing. So that helps a lot, doesn't it? It makes it a little harder. How many people in here, just for information, have written a living will?
didn't do that. I wrote a paper statement. Not to do.
Statement, that's anything. Advanced directives. Not very many. How many are going to go home and consider it? How many have them sitting on your desk at home? Not filled out. Not helpful in a car accident. All right. So, with the living will and discussions with family, it's important to have discussion about beliefs regarding, or in reference to, I should say that is, quality of life. My mother sits in a nursing home in Minneapolis. She currently can still walk. She recognizes us, I can tell by her face. Another year or two or three, when her Alzheimer's is worse, she won't be able to walk. She won't know us. She would never say to me, I begged her. I begged her to tell me, what is quality of life for you, mother? What is important for you to have? How will we make some decisions? She said, you kids will know best. How many kids in our family? Five kids in our family. You kids will do what is important to do, and God will take care of the rest. Helpful, Mom. I'm still angry at her for that. I tried. So the nursing home says to me, Mary, we have this, it's a great nursing home, it's Lutheran Nursing Home, Ebenezer. It says, we've got this progressive policy that says we ask every family or every resident, if they're competent, what they want in terms of the resuscitation you were talking about. Do they want cardiopulmonary resuscitation if their heart stops? Of course, my mother can't answer that. So they ask us. We haven't decided yet. If all five of us agree, one way or the other, that's what they'll do. If we don't do anything, they will resuscitate. They will err on the side of life, which, in my opinion, they ought to be doing. But I don't dare bring it up. Me, I know this stuff. I don't want to call the family together again and say, now, you guys, we need to decide what to do. Because this could happen any time. It might not. She's only 59. She's pretty young. She's not going to have a heart attack soon. But, okay, second, wishes for a proxy decision maker. Now, in Minnesota, this is the best part of our bill. Because if we write nothing else on our living will, our one-page living will, but I want this person to speak for me, that will do lots. That will go so far. That will prevent having to go through a long guardianship court kind of thing. Now, who's going to be responsible? The best thing we can do, I've had a lot of legislators say, and the people for the senior citizens lobby in Minnesota say, if you do nothing else, say who you want to speak for you. And put two names down, in case the first one is dead, or not competent, or out of the country, list somebody else. It's very, very important to do. Let me just list them all, and then we'll have some more.
Like, don't put the five kids.
Like, don't put all five of my kids. Yeah. Yeah, that doesn't help. Now, on the other hand, listing one kid is kind of tough.
Yeah.
Would you want me to make decisions for you? That's the question. Then, wishes about resuscitation. Can I spell it? And life supports. Now, generally speaking, I'm going to separate out here the food and fluid issue, but this usually refers to cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And again, definitions are important. This usually refers to a respirator. This is trying to bring you back, and this keeps you going. Simplify it. Now, we know there's lots of other definitions, and we can have some questions about that. Fourth, wishes regarding hydration and nutrition. Do you believe that tube feedings are artificially prolonging life, or are your right to have to sustain your life? What do you believe about that? If you all wanted answers today, I'm sorry about that.
Mary, can I ask you a question?
You sure can. Yep.
Supposing you said you didn't want tube feeding, et cetera, nutrition and hydration, then, and we're thinking now that we're in kind of a critical terminal situation, would that also then apply if you were in some other less critical medical situation in which that would be just a normal procedure, and you said no?
temporary thing, like a car accident.
Yeah. Yeah,
but you can't respond.
Yeah, I can't respond.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it'd be the same.
You want to be careful of that wording. I think you want your wording to say something like, you know, my life could not, if I could not live.
Yeah, my chances of recovery are negative in terms of three doctors.
Because otherwise you're right. All of
yeah,
sudden,
I mean, if I have lost blood in a car accident and I need something temporary to get me going,
sure. That's a big one for like Mrs. O'Connor with the stroke. When she was given hydration for a period of time, she perked up. She was able to kind of look around and know where she was. And particularly the few weeks to months after a stroke, a lot of ability can be regained by perhaps using these artificial means as part of the treatment. That's a good question. Let me just get right here. One thing I want to say about organ donation before time gets away is you may or may not be aware of the fact that even if, how many of your states have donor stickers or something you can put on your driver's license? Is that national? I think it is national. Do you know that if you have that on your driver's license, you are in a car accident, you're critically injured, you're brain dead, which is also defined differently in lots of states, but your organs, some of your organs could be, quote, harvested. I love that term, too. Or used by somebody else. You wanted it. It's on your driver's license. They search you, and your family says, no way, they won't take them. They won't take the organs, even if you wanted them on your driver's license. It's true in Minnesota. Yeah.
Because if you have the living will on you, too, and you're also a daughter, and they can't sustain your life to harvest your things. I mean, it's like almost like you're contradicting.
The difference there is a living will is used only when people still are brain living. That's where brain dead as a medical legal definition comes into play. People's organs cannot be taken until they are determined brain dead and the living will has nothing, no bearing then at that time. Does that make sense? It's difficult. Somebody has to define it. It's neurologist or neurosurgeon, I believe, are the people who need to be called in to define some. How'd you like that job? Define somebody as brain dead or not. But the critical thing about the organ donation is then to have talked about it. Because if you have said to your three children and your wife, I want my organs donated, it'll be a lot harder for them to say, no, don't do it. If they've heard you and that's in their heads, that's in their hearts, it's much more difficult. But that was a shock to me. And that's a big ethical question, too. Lots of different religions believe different things about life and the potential to give life to somebody else from our lives, or the fact that we are individuals and our life is over, it's God's, and we're done. Big questions about that. Okay, so these are the six I would suggest. Kind of a heavy topic. Kind of a heavy discussion to have with family members. But I would say it's probably the most important you'll ever have. Much more important than whether you want to be cremated or buried. Much more important than where you want to be buried, in my opinion.
Right.
Yeah.
Earlier you suggested a better method than having physicians alone make the decision is to have the family, the physician, the clergy make the decision in the consultation. Are there any clergy in here? And if so, what would you say? Is there anything in the Bible that you would call upon to help family make that decision?
Oh, good question. I'm glad I'm not a clergy. Daughter of one, but any clergy want to respond? Have families come to you and say, in this situation, what are we going to do? We don't know what he'd want. He didn't tell us. I'll bet you get 50 clergy and 50 answers. What do you think?
I'll tell you what my clergy had told us. When he came, we went to him. He said, have both of you accepted the fact that, you know, Fred's dying? Have I given him up? And when he laid hands on us and prayed for us, we went away.
It was wicked. We had the bishop at my father's bedside when he was dying of a third cardiac arrest in a month. And he had been resuscitated three times. The third time, he was in the cardiac care unit. We all witnessed his attack. We all witnessed the team rushing in, pounding on his chest. It was an awful experience. My mother at that time looked at us and said, I'm going to tell them not to do that again to Dad. He has another heart attack. We all said, that's it, right? Don't.
Well, that brings up a good point in terms of physicians, particularly I'll pick on them, explaining to the lay people, to families, what it means. You know, I've heard physicians, you want everything done for,
don't you?
For, you know, Johnny, don't you, or for, you know, your father. And the family sitting there, of course we want everything done for him. Well, you know, and I have followed in those footsteps. On only one occasion have I done this. I went up to that same family and I said, what he was talking about was, do you want us to be on his chest and put a tube down his throat to make him breathe? And they said, no, of course we don't want that.
You know? Are you a nurse?
Yeah.
How to define everything done in the 1980s is different than everything done in the 40s, the 30s, the 20s. Be different in the 1990s. I've heard a lot of physicians debate amongst themselves on a team caring for one person. Do we tell the family all that can be done? Because what they don't know, they won't ask for. Now, there's an ethical decision. And I, as a social worker, many times, family conferences, we have 20 people around, we have the docs, we have the residents, we have the nurse, the primary nurse. They'd all leave the room, the family looked at me and said, what did he mean by everything done? I call the nurse back. I say, what did he mean by everything? How do you say that? How do you define it in lay terms? How do you talk about what it is to see a loved one get pushed on them, breaking ribs or, you know, whatever it might be? I mean, it can be life-saving. It can also be battery. I don't know.
I have a friend whose husband had a stroke. And the doctor said, we can operate and remove the clot. And perhaps, you know, they couldn't promise he would be all right. So he had asked her never to allow such a thing. So, you know, in the stress of the moment, you feel like you should do something for the person. They did it. This was some 5 years later I went to visit. All he can talk about is how unhappy and miserable he is. There's nothing good about it. He had gone through extreme pain after he came home from other parts of his body. Of course, she had no idea that was going to happen.
And she did the best she could under the pressure.
Right. But the man himself was extremely unhappy. And I thought, what a thing this poor woman had to live with for these years. Mm-hmm. His telling everybody that came along, you know, about this horrible experience and how much he wished he'd been allowed to die. And he was a fine Christian man. Unhappy all his life.
You know, I wish I could have brought living wills and passed them out so we could all be looking at them, but they're different in every state. It's not really worth my doing that. But I would suggest people who want to know about it, check with the hospital social worker clergy departments in your local hospital. Those people know a lot. If you have a senior federation, if you're over 65 in town, check with them because they often know. Any other suggestions on where to find out? Your legislature would know if it's a...
But also, like with living wills, don't go and wait two or more than 2 years to see if your state has the same form or is honoring that form that you had filled out 2 years ago.
Yep.
That again is changing so fast. Yep. That
most statutes say this really ought to be updated yearly.
Yes.
And you ought to have the conversation yearly.
Yes.
And medicine is changing so quickly, you might want to add or subtract something. That's a very good point.
Well, if you move from state to state, you should check it out then.
That's right. Should do a new one. As far as I know, states don't honor each other's. Not on this yet. There may be a national at some point, but it's a long time coming. Okay. I think we're going to stop. Thank you for your attention.